welcome. Administrative note, Judge Newsom is not going to be participating in the second case. Judge Julie Carnes is. What we will do is take a 10-minute break between the first and the second case so we can, as they say, reconstitute the court. With that said, first up is Pitch versus United States. Mr. Henshelwood.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Brett Henshelwood for the United States. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E codifies the traditional rule of grand jury secrecy.
Adjust the microphone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Codifies the traditional rule of grand jury secrecy. Rule 6E2, titled Secrecy, provides that unless these rules provide otherwise, non-witness participants in the grand jury must not disclose matters occurring before the grand jury. Rule 6E3, titled Exceptions, then lays out most of the circumstances in which these rules provide otherwise for the disclosure of grand jury materials.
Can I ask you a quick question about sub A, secrecy to sub A? Everybody sort of seems to proceed directly to sub B, which is the prohibitions, and A seems to start, counterintuitively to me, with like a general rule of openness, right? It says no obligation of secrecy may be imposed on any person except as follows. And it just seems counter to everything you read about sort of Rule 6. Rule 6 is intended to ensure secrecy, but you read, and it seems, the structure of the rule seems to suggest that the over kind of riding ethic is openness. What do you make of that?
Your Honor, Rule 6E2A addresses particularly those individuals who are present in the grand jury proceeding, with the sole exception of witnesses. So the point of Rule 6E2A, as the 1946 Rules Committee notes, promulgation of the original rule explained, is to ensure that witnesses are not themselves prevented from disclosing, for example, their testimony, to the substance of their testimony to their counsel. But for everyone else who's involved in the grand jury proceeding and thus privy to matters occurring before the grand jury, the rule absolutely is secrecy. And always has been secrecy, and that's...
Hey, I guess, really just applies to witnesses. It just seems like an odd way to structure the rule if, like, nobody can disclose except witnesses, and instead the rule says everybody can disclose except the following five people, except the following five individuals, and A seemingly then only applies to witnesses. Just seems like such an odd way to structure the rule.
Well, Your Honor, I think it was partially designed. I mean, I think if you compare, for example, 6E2A with Rule 6D, which lists who may be present in the grand jury proceedings, you sort of see why they might have followed that structure. But regardless, there's no doubt that as to individuals present in the grand jury, with the exception of the witness, Rule 6E2 makes very clear that they are bound by the rule of secrecy. And as a practical matter, those are the individuals who are privy to grand jury secrets, to matters occurring before the grand jury, and who... are subject potentially to the exceptions in Rule 6E3, including the limited circumstances in which...
See, the problem, the textual problem from over here that you have is the preface to the rule here is any person. Any means every. I mean, it's all encapsulating. So I think Judge Newsom's point is it's everyone except the seven that are listed under B. Why isn't that a reasonable and plausible way to come at it?
Your Honor, I mean, reasonable and plausible in the sense that I want to make sure I'm following your question. That, I mean, certainly the individuals who are present in the grand jury room are bound by the rule of secrecy because they are aware of what's happening. They know of matters occurring before the grand jury. And that notably does not generally include the district court or any other individual with the exception of the witness. And the Supreme Court has said in the past that, you know, witnesses are not generally bound by that rule of secrecy unless they fall into one of the other enumerated classes. That was part of the Supreme Court's decision in Sells Engineering. So, you know, there's no doubt that as to people present in the grand jury, including the attorney for the government and other figures, they are bound by the rule of secrecy. And then the exceptions in Rule 6E3 enumerate the circumstances in which that obligation can be lifted.
I have another question about the application of Rule 6. Rule 6E1 says that the government shall retain control of the grand jury materials, basically. And that didn't happen in this case. We have a pleading from the U.S. attorney before the district court that said, you know, we never kept grand jury materials until 2004. They were retained by the court. And we, as far as we know, we've never had the grand jury materials from this 1946 proceeding. So how does that affect our analysis, our application of Rule 6?
I don't think it affects it at all, Your Honor. I mean, the point is Rule 6E is designed to regulate information about the matters that occur before the grand jury, wherever that information is held.
Mr. Pitch ultimately found these from the National Archives, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So you would impose the obligation of secrecy on the National Archives?
Your Honor, that's actually true by statute. So 44 U.S.C. 2108, which regulates the National Archives.
You're not traveling under that. You're traveling under Rule 6E, correct?
Well, Your Honor, when records move to the custody of the National Archives, by statute, they come subject to the same restrictions that they were on or they were under when they were held by the originating agency. So in this case, the obligation of secrecy under Rule 6E runs with the records when they go to the National Archives.
The order entered by the district court was an order to the United States Attorney to disclose the record. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And so what you're saying then is by operation of that statute, then the Department of Justice would somehow ask the National Archives to retrieve the record for them? Is that...
Or, Your Honor, I mean, it would lift the obligation of secrecy that ran with the records when they went to the archives, and the archives could process
them.
But
it would have been the responsibility of the department or the U.S. attorney, someone in the executive branch, to get that record from the archives to comply with the order?
Right, or, yeah, for the archives to process it.
Where is that in the record?
Your Honor, I mean... The statute is publicly available.
This is the statute governing the National Archives.
Correct, Your Honor. 44 U.S.C. 2108.
The U.S. Attorney's Manual only requires that the government retain these records for 10 years, right?
Right. I think that might be correct. I won't speak to the contents of the manual because I'm not certain, but what I will say is that...
Well, I was getting that from the pleading. So, I mean, that's what the U.S. Attorney said in their pleading. So, the government attorney is not charged with keeping these records forever.
Right. Congress has separately provided for all executive branch records, not just grand jury records, but has provided that they will be kept by the National Archives subject to specified procedures. And so that's sort of how the records end up there. But that doesn't alter the fact that the records are subject to Rule 6E, as all grand jury information is subject to Rule 6E.
But the records are not in the custody of the court.
Your Honor, I believe in this particular instance, so that the court could conduct an assessment of whether disclosure was permissible, mm-hmm. copies of the records were filed with the district court to mm-hmm. allow the judge to
but
conduct that
assessment.
But it would
not have ordinarily been in the custody of the court.
Correct, Your Honor. Ordinarily, I think the typical procedure.
Then who filed it with the court?
The attorney for the government provided those to the court ex parte to enable it to conduct its assessment.
Most grand jury records, or the vast majority of grand jury records, are destroyed after a period of time. Only a select few are preserved for historical reasons in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Is that right?
Your Honor, I'm not certain what the exact standards are for sort of which records get retained and which ones do not. I mean, certainly these records did get retained in the National Archives.
I guess what I don't understand is if there are a select few records that are reserved for historical reasons in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., it doesn't make sense that no one can ever see them, that historians cannot see records that are preserved for historical reasons.
Your Honor, records aren't preserved in the National Archives, I think, solely for historical purposes. I mean, sometimes records are kept, or even if they are, it's not surprising that classified information and other material as well is retained in the National Archives for future reference.
But a district court can redact in order to protect us from national security concerns in the event that we decided to remand this case back to the district court. Judge Treadwell could conduct redaction if there are information in the grand jury materials that should not be disclosed, right?
Certainly,
isn't that within the inherent authority of a district court to do that?
Certainly, a district court could undertake redactions and obviously invited redactions in this particular case, but that assumes that the district court had the power to disclose the records in the first place.
And what do we do with the earlier this year, Congress passed and the president signed into law the Civil Rights Cold Case Records Act? Is this a cold case record?
Your Honor, it might be. I mean, the Act sets out specific criteria for which cases and which records apply, and tasks actually the review board under the Act with determining, you know, whether a record qualifies. And
I'm looking at paragraph 2 of the Act. It says, all government records concerning civil rights cold cases shall carry a presumption of immediate disclosure, and all records shall be eventually disclosed to enable the public to become fully informed about the history of the surrounding cases. Mm-hmm. If we say that the records in the Moore's lynching case shall not be disclosed, wouldn't that violate the will of Congress? Congress passed this law saying these civil rights cold cases should be disclosed to the public for historical reasons.
No, Your Honor, this court wouldn't be saying that the records could never come out under any mechanism. To the extent that the review board in the future were to determine that these records fall within the Act and to request the Attorney General to seek their disclosure through that mechanism, nothing about a decision from this court about a district court's inherent power would block that.
But two judicial conference committees, haven't they, have already said that there's, I mean, courts already have the inherent authority to disclose these records.
There are minutes of one committee that declined to pass forward a proposal from then Attorney General Holder addressing historically significant records, but that material doesn't say anything about what the text of the rule meant in 1946 or 1977.
But that's how those committees interpreted the rule, that courts already have the inherent authority to disclose these grand jury records for historical reasons in rare and exceptional cases.
Your Honor, I mean, that material doesn't speak to the actual question of what the text of the rule meant when Congress enacted it or when the Supreme Court enacted it. And
but
there's
they're
a reason
interpreting the text of Congress as courts already have the inherent authority. We don't need to revise the rule, right?
Your Honor, that's a sort of one of the four committee, one of the four entities within the rulemaking process that considers whether a rule is appropriate, and it's you know, in that sense, it's functionally equivalent to, you know, post-enactment legislative history, and I think that's why the Seventh Circuit in Carlson, a decision with which we disagree, didn't give any weight to those notes in making its decision, and I think that's the appropriate course for the court to take
here. In fact, the Advisory Committee on Criminal Rules, speaking through Judge Raggi, in her report to the Standing Rules Committee said the courts basically have agreed on this, and it would be premature to enact a national rule at this time. Basically, there's no need, because at that time there was no circuit split.
Correct, Your Honor, and Judge Raggi's indications in the minutes also are that she was concerned about, you know, how wide-ranging a change might be, given that the rule has always assumed that materials are secret, you know, for as long as, you know.
Well,
you know,
she
more
was
or less
talking
permanent.
About her conversations with the National Archives.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that was in an information-only report to the Standing Rules Committee. The Standing Rules Committee never made any decision on it anyway, and that's that would not really be a decision of a court anyway.
All of that is correct, Your Honor, yes.
Let me ask you a question. In 1984, this court faced a problem in Hastings. And in that case, the court held that there was inherent power to disgorge records. The context was different. But nevertheless, the court unambiguously held there was inherent power for this court reviewing committee to disgorge, to get access to the grand jury materials, which existed and were held by the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of Florida at the time. If you're right, and Hastings was incorrect in finding inherent power subsequent to the adoption of the rules in 1946, would there have been any way for that committee to get access to those grand jury materials?
Your Honor, the question
which
then,
were very, very important.
Your Honor, the question then would have been whether the judicial committee's proceedings qualify as a judicial proceeding under
the first. Yes, I understand. Was it preliminary to or part of a judicial proceeding? Would those materials, in your view, otherwise have been available?
If they didn't fall within one of the exceptions, no.
Well, I'm asking, did they fall within any of the exceptions?
Your Honor, we haven't taken a position on that issue here. I don't have an answer on that particular point. But then you're still interpreting
are you aware
the text.
Are you aware that several circuits have held that attorney misconduct proceedings fit within that exception?
Your Honor, certainly courts have, yes, held that, and the Supreme Court in Bagot noted that whether something qualifies as judicial proceeding
any
is a particularly...
Any reason why that would be true for attorney misconduct proceedings and not true for judicial misconduct proceedings?
Your Honor, I mean, I think that would be certainly an argument in favor of concluding that they were judicial proceedings where you have Article III judges conducting a proceeding. But what you're talking about there, Your Honor, is a dispute about whether something falls within the text of the rule. And the court in Hastings was very clear that its decision in part rested on the fact that the disclosure being sought was very close to one of the enumerated exceptions.
Nevertheless,
that's very different.
Of course, it felt obliged, however, to use inherent power. Obviously, it wasn't fully satisfied it could do it simply with the text. And so I'm just asking whether, if you're right and there is no inherent power, would these rules have provided for disgorgement of those grants? Your answer is, I don't have to answer it because it's not in front of me now.
My answer is I don't have a position on that question. I don't know what the answer would be, but at least there, unlike here, you're talking about the text of an enumerated exception and not a court deciding it wants to create a wholly new exception by invoking its inherent power.
Thank you, Mr. Henswood. We'll hear from Mr. Bell now.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Joseph J. Bell of the law firm of Bell & Chivas, New Jersey, on behalf of the late Anthony Pitch and his personal representatives, along with Laura Wexler. I thank the court for the privilege of appearing before the circuit this morning in a shared quest to shine the light of truth on an appalling injustice, the last mass lynching in America. What better case is before this panel or this circuit than the one that you have today, embracing Hastings and examining the role of the court as an instrument of justice?
Can I maybe cut to the chase a little bit? So inherent authority, why is it from a standpoint of first principles that we would assume that courts have inherent authority with respect to grand jury proceedings at all? I mean, the grand jury, the Supreme Court has said, certainly most recently, despite a few sort of false starts early, has said most recently the grand jury exists outside the judicial branch, right? It's its own thing. And with respect to inherent authority, when the Supreme Court talks about inherent authority, they're talking about things that happen in front of a district court judge's face, under his or her nose. You know, contempt proceedings, decorum in the courtroom, managing dockets. It just seems to me that the district court is sort of divorced from the grand jury proceeding. It empanels the grand jury and then accepts the indictment, but between A and B is not even permitted to be in the room. Why would we assume that the district court has inherent authority over the grand jury proceeding at all?
Well, I think that's embodied in the Constitution, Your Honor, and I also believe it's embodied in case law that permeates throughout the country, that the court, as an instrument of justice, has that inherent supervisory authority, as you did in Hastings. If you find that there's...
Well, the beauty of the in-bank process is that Hastings is what it is, but it doesn't bind this court. So I'm curious about sort of first principles. So let's talk about the Constitution. You said it's embedded in the Constitution. Where is that?
Well, it's embedded as the grand jury is an arm of the judiciary and is an arm of a judiciary.
Where does it say that the grand jury is an arm of the judiciary? I always thought, and maybe I've got it wrong, that the grand jury was sort of in its own orbit. It wasn't part of the executive branch, although the executive branch plays a role. The prosecutor goes in, acts as the lawyer for the grand jury. It wasn't a part of the judicial branch, although the judiciary impanels the grand jury and receives an indictment that's returned, but that the grand jury was in its own orbit. Isn't that right, historically, that the grand jury was understood as a very distinct body, having its own powers, its own origins, and they were distinct from both the judicial and executive branch?
Except that you have that supervisory role over the grand jury to make sure that it comports with the Constitution and the laws of the state and the United States.
I think what Judge Marcus and I are getting at is that you just keep saying that, but why is that so? Why is that so that there is this supervisory authority from a district court judge to a grand jury proceeding when, as Judge Marcus says, the grand jury exists sort of outside
well,
the district court judge's ambit?
to make sure that it acted within the parameters of its charge, to make sure that the witnesses brought forth testimony that was accurate, truthful.
Counsel, isn't the answer, because the Supreme Court said so in the Pittsburgh plate glass case?
Pittsburgh plate glass, yes, Your Honor.
And that, course, an and that prior to 1946, when the rule was established, it was always understood that district judges had the inherent authority with respect to the disclosure of grand jury materials. That and the Supreme Court affirmed that in the Pittsburgh plate glass case.
That's correct, Your Honor. But you know what this
can you point to any pre-Rule 6 case where a court ever allowed the disclosure of a grand jury record to the general public?
I think that always was vested within the inherent supervisory authority
not
of the
question.
Court.
That's
and
not
I,
the question,
I think the
counsel.
Douglas case is the case on point in this particular matter. Pittsburgh plate glass is also
a disclosure to the general public.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting as well. The disclosure is within the inherent, I believe, also authority of the district court judge to make exacting standards, to look at the record, to redact the record, as Judge Treadwell indicated in the case in Pitch
but
below.
Is there an example?
Is there an example? I guess you would have to then use that inherent supervisory authority that the court has and manifest its trust and confidence in that district court judge.
Can you give us examples after 1946?
I believe Ethel and
Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
The Hiss case.
35-year-old grand jury deposition testimony.
And also Jimmy Hoffa's case.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Nixon and Watergate case. And most recently, I think there was a decision out of the District Court of the District of Columbia involving Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky in that case as well, where they released those records.
Counsel, let me ask you this. This case fits within the Cold Case Civil Rights Records Act of 2018, does it not?
That's interesting.
What I find interesting is it says it applies generally, subject to restrictions, to cases between January 1, 1940 through December 31, 1979, which occur in events arising during that period and that are civil rights cases. And this would definitely fit that application definition, would it not?
Well, you know, Your Honor, that's very interesting.
I know it's interesting. That's why I'm asking.
Well,
I'm
trying to address that. The Cold
would
case,
it fit within those two categories?
No, because I still think that the court has the inherent supervisory.
No, that's not the question, counsel. The question is, if the Supreme Court of the United States said this morning, hold the presses, courts don't have any inherent authority, would this act permit you to go before the panel of experts and get a request to unseal these?
I think it still would be contingent upon the Attorney General granting the access to the...
Exactly. And the Attorney General says, I am all for this. If I had
then why is he here today?
Because he doesn't think you have authority to get a court to do it without some specific rule provision or legislation. And this case started when there was no Civil Rights Cold Case Records Collection Act.
That's correct.
Now we've got one. And everybody, I think, recognizes that when Congress has spoken to a specific authority or restriction on authority, you can't change that with a rule. And you can't change that with inherent court authority.
But you can change it, Your Honor, too, in this particular case. And there's no finer case that I believe that exists out there today that recognizes the inherent historical significance that the court has.
That's why Congress enacted the Civil Rights Records Collection Act of 2018, counsel, to govern those cases. And to the extent a court comes in and says, that's all well and good, I know it took a number of years, I know they were acting on the recommendation of the Department of Justice, whose position has been consistent throughout that we need this kind of authority, and I know Congress enacted that, but we don't want to fool with it. We just want to go before a single judge and get the single judge to say, emanations from on high, inherent authority, I order it released. Forget about the board of experts. Forget about the recommendations. Forget about the application clause. I can do it faster. That's what's at stake here. It's not whether this is, there's not a person involved in this case, touching this case, who doesn't realize that this is historically significant material. I would love to have it released and read a book about it. But the question is one of rule of law process, whether you can have a court circumvent a statute as well as arguably a rule, but certainly a statute, and say we can do it easier. Forget what Congress said.
I believe you can do it both ways, Your Honor. As you know, this case began some 7 years ago.
If you can do it inherent authority, why have the act?
Can I ask you a question, counsel?
I'm sorry, I'd like an answer to my question first.
I'm sorry, would you please repeat that?
If you can do it with inherent authority, why did Congress go to the trouble of enacting the statute to provide how you could do it and when you could do it?
I think the distinction in this particular case is whether or not the United States Attorney would acquiesce in the release of these grand jury transcripts.
Let me ask you a question about that. Does the Civil Rights Records Act authorize release of grand jury materials other than historical records pertaining to civil rights?
Well, I think the Cole
through case, inherent. I mean, does it authorize it at all? That's the first question. Just yes or no.
I don't know if it's clear because it's brand new. It's a brand new law that was adopted in January of this year, and the Cold Case Collection Act, I think, is fully consistent.
Well, let me ask you this. If Rule 60 had not been amended to authorize release of the records that were released by the court in Hastings, would the Civil Rights Records Act have authorized release of those materials in that case?
I'm not sure, because I think if the government today here is opposing application.
Not today. I'm asking at the time that this happened in 1984, could the grand jury records have been released under the Civil Rights Records Act if it existed in 1984?
I'm not sure.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Were they civil rights records?
I think they are civil rights
records. No, the Hastings records.
Case involved an abrogation of the civil rights of four human beings that were slaughtered in Monroe County, yes.
No, the Alcee Hastings records.
Oh, his records. His records, yes, because I think the court took a very careful eye and noted we don't want any aspersions on the character or of the court. The court has always been, especially in today's world,
I'm just asking if it could have been released under the Civil Rights Records Act. If the Civil Rights Records
I don't Act, think that was a Civil Rights Act.
Right, so it couldn't have been released. Right. So I guess the question then is, does the Civil Rights Records Act speak to whether the court has inherent authority in general to release grand jury materials?
I think if, in fact, the Attorney General or whatever U.S. attorney is involved in it denied the use, then I think an application could be made to the court again.
But if I could ask you to just sort of directly focus on my question. Does the Civil Rights Records Act authorize courts to authorize the release of records in all inherent authority types of situations in which courts have previously exercised their inherent authorities, their inherent authority to release grand jury records?
You know, I think the law is too new to be able to opine on that particular issue, Your Honor. I don't think the Records Act has come across any cases involving the case as stands before you today.
It says most of the records related to the civil rights cold cases are almost 50 years old, like this one. And only in the rarest cases is there any legitimate need for continued protection of such records. Is it conceivable that this law was enacted and signed by the president in order to satisfy any reservations that the courts might have about whether these grand jury records in these civil rights cold cases are available to be released to the public? Is that conceivable?
That's conceivable.
Because your argument, as I understand it from your briefs, is that with regard to Rule 6, there's no need to revise Rule 6 because two judicial conference committees have already determined that courts already have the inherent authority to, in these rare and exceptional cases, to release grand jury materials. Is that the argument that you made in your brief?
Yes, correct.
Counsel, let me ask you about that second part of that argument. In fact, the standing committee, there's advisory committees on criminal rules, civil rules, appellate rules, bankruptcy rules, et cetera. And then there's a standing committee which filters some of those proposals, will send them back for hearings or not, and then sends them on to the Supreme Court, which may or may not send them to Congress. The Standing Committee didn't take any action whatsoever on this proposal. In fact, the minutes, which are before us, list it as an information item among other information items, which, oh, by the way, this is why we're not bringing a proposal before you. That doesn't mean that the Standing Committee approved or disapproved anything in the information report. Correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Let me ask you again. Did you ever make an application under the Cold Case Records Act for access to these materials?
We did not, because the decision of the panel of the circuit court came subsequent to the enactment of the Cold Case Act.
If you were to lose here on this issue, could you not go back to that review committee and seek access to records that are plainly cold case civil rights records?
Well, I hope I don't have to take that.
No, I understand that question, but I'm asking a different one. Is there anything in the act itself that would bar or impede you from using it to get these very records?
I'm not sure. I don't believe so. I don't believe. I think I could make an application to that panel successful here.
And as Judge Raggi pointed out in her information report, I've talked to the National Archivist, and he thinks everything ought to be released. And he thinks after a certain period of time, they presumptively ought to be released. So you know how that's going to go. And then the Attorney General has said at every stage of this proceeding that I've seen that we think they ought to be released. You just can't do it under inherent authority given the fact that Rule 6 lists the exceptions. So it sounds like to me you've got a winning argument under the Civil Rights Cold Case Act of 2018.
Thank you. I'll be seated. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Henselwood, you've got your full 5 minutes. I didn't misstate the government's position about the desirability of releasing these as a policy matter, right?
No, you did not, Your Honor. I mean, as we've been clear throughout this proceeding, I think in all of our briefs, that we don't have objections to disclosure of these particular records. But I think to go back to a question or a couple of questions that Judge Marcus and Judge Newsom were asking earlier, the district court's exercise of inherent power over grand jury materials has always been limited to the same circumstances in which its inherent power is exercised in managing its own proceedings. So it's for the protection and vindication of the judicial process.
Is that true with regard to, it looks like there have been 6 times in the history of our nation when grand jury materials have been released to the public. And, you know, you've got that list in the briefs. So did the courts in all 6 of those cases violate Rule 6? My interpretation seems to be consistent with the history of how this rule has been interpreted, and the Supreme Court hasn't frowned upon the release of grand jury records for historical reasons before.
Right, because the Supreme Court's never addressed that question because it's repeatedly emphasized that the exceptions themselves are exclusive, as in Bagot, that they embody policy judgments about what purposes justify disclosure, just as the Civil Rights Cold Case Act
The district courts in all 6 of these cases violated Rule 6?
Correct, Your Honor. And to go back to this point about inherent power, where courts exercised their inherent authority before the promulgation of Rule 6E, it went to a proceeding actually occurring before the court, so potentially to dismiss an indictment that had been procured by misconduct, or to enable a witness to refresh the recollection of a party to refresh the recollection of a witness at trial.
And so in those particular cases, were those cases where Rule 6E authorized the disclosure?
So today, those exceptions are embodied? Rule 6E didn't exist at the time.
Oh, okay.
Right. So the point is that when district courts exercised inherent authority prior to the promulgation of Rule 6E...
I understand the point you're making. Let me ask you this question, though, about inherent authority. Would you agree that the courts that have released documents pursuant to inherent authority have done so in ways that would not qualify under the Civil Rights Records Act?
Correct, Your Honor. I'm not aware of another case.
Right. And so if the question that we have to determine here today, or at least one of the questions we have to determine here today, is whether courts have inherent authority to release records, grand jury records, outside of Rule 6E's specified exceptions, then we can't really look to the Civil Rights Records Act of 2018 as an answer to that question, because it doesn't explain the disclosures that courts have all of the disclosures that courts have previously made pursuant to their inherent authority after the enactment of Rule 6E. Wouldn't you agree?
Your Honor, it doesn't speak to the broader issue of historically interesting materials writ large. I agree with you on that point, but my point is that those disclosures are inconsistent with any recognized conception of inherent authority from the Supreme Court.
And I do understand your point on that, but that's the next point, right? The first point is, do courts have inherent authority at all to release grand jury material, right? And that is not a question that is answered by the enactment of the Civil Rights Records Act, right?
Right. No, it doesn't speak to that question. But
right. So first we have to answer that question. If we think that there is inherent authority, then we can get to the next question, which is, I think, the point you're making, right?
Well, you're right. But I think what the Act does is it illustrates that Congress is perfectly capable of making the types of policy judgments the Supreme Court talked about in Bagot as when it enacts exceptions to the rules. And that's exactly what the exceptions in Rule 6E, 3E embody.
That's a different argument than whether courts have inherent authority at all to go outside of the specified exceptions of Rule 6E, isn't it?
I mean, they're, I think, complementary, but you're right, they're different insofar as, you know, our point is that to the extent district courts exercised inherent authority before 1946, that inherent authority got codified into the rule in the first two exceptions under Rule 6E, 3E, and that there's no remaining inherent authority. And this gets to a point, you know, I think that goes back to something Judge Marcus was asking me earlier, which is that as to, for example, the records in Hastings, there's at least an argument there that it's consistent with the vindication and protection of the judicial process.
Right, but if you look at once the rule is codified, the rule changes over time, and many of the changes appear to have followed the district courts having exercised inherent authority. For example, the rule didn't originally say that a prosecutor could turn the materials over to an agent assisting him, or that a prosecutor could turn the grand jury materials of the first grand jury over to the second. They went to the courts, and the courts said, yeah, you can do that. And then the rulemakers said, sounds like a good idea, let's embody it in the rules. Did those district court judges act beyond their inherent authority when they did that?
Your Honor, I think in virtually all those cases, what you see is courts wrestling with the actual text of the rule. So the 1983 amendment you're referring to, Your Honor, about disclosures between two grand juries, there was actually a circuit split on the question of whether the text of the rule permitted those disclosures between the Second and Fifth Circuits. So that's a fundamentally different type of question from a district court saying,
what you're saying is that the exercise of inherent power was in a slightly different context than for historical purposes. But what I'm asking is whether or not the district courts had some inherent authority post-codification to say to the prosecutor he could turn it over to the case agent, or to say to the prosecutor he could turn it over to another grand jury. Did inherent authority go at least that far post-codification of the rules in 46?
You know, I don't believe it did, Your Honor. So
those district courts acted ultra vires when they told the prosecutor he could turn the materials over to a second grand jury until the rule itself reached that conclusion.
Your Honor, many of those courts believed they were applying the text of the rule as written rather than exercising any sort of inherent power. So I don't think it makes sense to say necessarily that they all were exercising their inherent authority and believed that was the only way
make
such disclosures.
To follow up on this, there was nothing in the rule that said originally a prosecutor could turn over the grand jury materials to a second succeeding grand jury in that district, or maybe one halfway around the country. They went to the court and said, we want to turn these materials over to another grand jury. District judge said, yeah, you can do it.
Your Honor, I believe the
context... Did that district court exercise inherent authority in doing it before it was embodied in the rule?
Your Honor, the cases I'm aware of that raised this issue actually arose in the context of criminal prosecutions where a disclosure had happened with no permission from the court, and the argument was made that that tainted the prosecution. So both Garcia and Malatesta, the Second and Fifth Circuit cases that split on this question, recall that, you know, many disclosures of grand jury material within the executive branch happen with no involvement from the court at all, and that's what happened in those cases. So I think that also gets to some of your concern.
Wouldn't the rules say may only in these circumstances, if it was intended that the rule abrogate inherent authority?
Your Honor, again, two points about that. First, the framing of abrogation assumes that there was an inherent power of this type beforehand. So if district courts never possessed the inherent power to disclose grand jury records because they were of historical interest, then the rule isn't abrogating any pre-existing power. And for the reasons we've explained, we don't think, you know, that's at issue here. And in any event, the text of the rule itself is clear that unless the rules provide otherwise, there is no permission to disclose grand jury materials.
So what you're really doing is you're exporting a subpart of the rule to another subpart of the rule, and I'm not aware of any rule of statutory construction that would permit a court to do that. Can you cite one?
Your Honor, when Congress lists specific exceptions to a general prohibition, courts don't generally assume or presume there are additional
But it uses
ones.
The words may do so.
Right, may authorize a disclosure.
Only do so. I mean, I don't want to argue with you, but it seems to me that I'm not aware of any instance where we have interpreted the word may as anything other than permissive.
Your Honor, you're correct. It's permissive within the text, within the context of the specific exceptions that are enumerated there. So just because you come in and say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, may I finish answering the question? Thank you. To the extent you come in as a petitioner and say, I'd like these materials for another judicial proceeding falling within one of the exceptions, that doesn't entitle you automatically to receipt of the records. The district court still has discretion to deny it. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court was
Counsel,
talking about in this court.
The answer, core answer, and you're past your time, so we'll take that case under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we're going to have a recess for 10 minutes now before we take up the Goble case.
All rise.